Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, from the recently in Phoenix, Arizona, you're listening to Breakthrough Thinking. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. I'm Dave Isaac, host of Breakthrough Thinking. And if it is the first Tuesday of each month from 2 to 3, it is Breakthrough Networking, starring Al Fulton. Al, nice seeing you.
Oh, hi, Dave. Nice seeing you. Thank you for having me on the show again.
Absolutely. And before we introduce our very special guest, I got to give Al another shout-out. Al's service, Greg, and our special guest, who I'll introduce in a second, is amazing. I mean, it just gets better and better. And I've said many things, how you rescued our website, a couple of years back now. And how I tripped over my laptop. The power thing got stuck in where you input. He said, "Come on down to one of his clients." He came down, fixed it in 5 seconds, and there I was at one of my favorite restaurants, Wildflower Bread Company, just last week. Oh, and our special guest likes that too, and we're going to talk to her about that. Now, here I was, and all of a sudden, it said 7% left on the battery. I'm plugged in. I don't understand it. I go, wait a minute. It's not working. And I have now down to 6%. Then down to 5%. I call Al. And Al said, "Where are you, Dave?" I go, "I'm a Wildflower Bread Company, 75th and Bell." And he said, "I'll be right there." He said, "I'm on 75th and Northern." A house call. Well, a restaurant call. I couldn't believe it. And boom, you tested it. You gave me a new cord or something.
Yes.
And it works. Al, again to the rescue, hardly lost any work time. Al, I'm not kidding you. I've never, ever seen customer service like that. Everyone should know you.
Well, thanks. Thanks for the nice words, Dave.
No question about it. It's just remarkable. It's like, I mean, that's like 5-6 times in a row.
Yeah, that's what customer service is about, and that's what we strive to do.
Well, I'll tell you, it's phenomenal, and your team is phenomenal, too. They've helped me on, you know, setting up the online backup, which is really, I recommend everyone go through on that.
Yes.
Because it automatically backs up all your data.
Exactly.
Or whatever data you want, I should say.
Correct.
So they helped me on that. And, we may need it on that computer eventually. Okay. Is it good to have it on 3 computers?
Oh, yes, you can. Any pertinent files, data files, email, content.
Yeah.
Anything that's important. Absolutely.
So probably good. What do you think, Greg? We should probably do that. Whatever I think can be scary sometimes. Okay. Anyway, our special guest, Al, because of you, you have a most unique guest.
Yes, I do.
And you want to introduce this young lady that on her shirt says, "Legally awesome." And just talking to her 5 minutes, she is awesome, legally and otherwise.
Yes, and her specialty, actually she wrote a book, and I'll let her discuss that, and that is the topic of our show today, and that is social media, things you should say, not say, she will elaborate on that. I will introduce her now. Her name is Ruth Carter, attorney, and Ruth, take it from there.
All right.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
It's called The Legal Side of Blogging.
Yes. So my name is Ruth Carter. I own Carter Law Firm here in Phoenix. And my firm focuses on business formation and contracts, intellectual property, social media law, and flash mob law. And last year I wrote the book, The Legal Side of Blogging, How Not to Get Sued, Fired, Arrested, or Killed.
Oh, wow. That's quite a mouthful. That's pretty good.
Thank you.
Is it 89 pages?
It's an ebook, so I have no idea how many pages it is when you actually put it in a book form, but it's about 27,000 words.
Wow, that would be, let's see, just to calculate, 89 pages.
There you go.
No, I read some reviews, and you had great reviews, by the way.
Thank you.
I Googled it. Now, what I failed to Google, and I see it in the bio, and I must have missed it, is this flash mob stuff. And before the show, I'm the only one here in this room that didn't know what a flash mob was. Can you explain that? What is a flash mob?
So a flash mob is an unexpected public performance designed to entertain and surprise an unsuspecting audience. So for anyone who's on YouTube, that's the people who are dancing in the street or posing like statues or participating in the, you know, no-pants subway ride, things like that. So as a flash mob attorney, where I am one of two flash mob attorneys in the country, we're the people behind the scenes who have to think about, okay, how many ways could this go wrong, or what could we be accused of doing wrong, and mitigate all that so that everybody has a good time, both the participants and the unsuspecting spectators who get to see us in action.
So basically, but it is planned and organized up front, though, the flash mob.
The people who are participating and organizing it are involved way in advance, but the audience usually doesn't know that it's coming.
Now, I think there was a movie, was it Valentine's Day, where at the end, Greg, I think you like that movie. Didn't they have a flash mob in New York?
No, that was a different one. That was the one where Timberlake and Mila Kunis were friends with benefits, and I think it was called Friends with Benefits.
Yeah, I think.
That was a flash mob.
Okay,
that was a real flash mob.
I saw it on Friends with Benefits. Yes, a flash mob. It was sort of cool.
It's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it.
But I've never seen one, though. I've been at the wrong place at the wrong time.
I guess so. I mean, if you wanted to participate in a flash mob in the Phoenix area, you can get on Improv Arizona's email list by going to improvaz.com, and you can be kept in the loop in our upcoming shenanigans, so you can participate.
And how often do you do these flash deals?
Flash deals.
Well, I mean the mob, flash mobs.
It depends. I mean, because we love doing flash mobs, but we do have day jobs. And we've learned from experience that when it gets very hot or very cold or rains, Arizonans are kind of wimps, at least the people in the Phoenix area. So, but we do try to do a handful of events a year, usually between, like, you know, maybe late September through maybe early May.
So, okay, September to early May. And where, you just, anywhere, right? Wherever you organize it. It could be at a mall.
It could be at a mall. It could be in public. We have to be careful when you're looking at flash mobs at shopping malls because they generally don't like it. So,
Oh yes.
There is, I know of at least one flash mob in the Valley that has put all of us on notice that if you do a flash mob there, you can expect to at least be banned from the mall, if not arrested for trespassing.
Is that illegal, though, as a flash mob attorney? Can they say it's trespassing?
Technically, probably, because malls are open to the public, but it's open to the public for the purpose of shopping. And when you're there to do something that is not shopping or otherwise disrupting the environment, they can tell you to leave. And if you don't leave, you're trespassing at that point. So they're kind of doing a preemptive strike by saying, if you do a flash mob, we're going to arrest you for trespassing.
Wow. But it would seem like that would be exciting for the general public to see that, though, and it would make it, like, if it leaked that it got out, hey, flash mob at 12:30, maybe people would show up at the mall.
They might, but then that means they may have to do crowd control, which maybe they don't want to do.
Okay. Yeah, actually, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Al, have you ever been part of a flash mob?
No, I've only seen them on the internet.
That's it. So you haven't seen it in person yet?
No.
Okay, we have a surprise for you today. Because live here at the Regent Suites, I'm kidding, we're not going to have a flash mob. But what if we did? Wouldn't that be a big surprise? That would be incredible. So the flash mob attorney, but as an attorney, where do you think you concentrate most on your practice, or where do you want it?
I definitely focus more on business law, whether it's, you know, formations, contracts, intellectual property, registrations, identification, strategies, and social media law.
Wow. That's big. That should be huge these days, social media. No one knows anything about that, right?
A lot of people think they know what they're doing, and they realize that they're doing it wrong when they have a big problem.
Wow. So do you get a lot of cases on that? Is that, or will it trend up?
It's definitely, I expect it to trend up.
Wow, that's amazing. So let's, on this YouTube thing, I did see, it wasn't a flash mob deal, but DMCA, Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Mm-hmm.
What's up with that? It sounds sort of complex.
It's actually not that complex. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act is part of the copyright law, and it is a law that's designed to protect the YouTubes of the world, you know, YouTube, Pinterest, websites and forums that provide a place for people to post content without actually controlling any of it. So if the web host gets what's called a DMCA takedown notice from somebody who claims, hey, one of your users is posting my content on your site without my permission, take it down, the web host has to remove it, and they'll tell the user, hey, we had to disable your video, your blog post, or whatever, because we got this takedown notice, and then the person who posted the content can either just leave it down because, yeah, they posted something they weren't supposed to, or they can send what's called a counter takedown notice and say, hey, got your note, but I own that content, so I don't know what that guy is telling you that it's theirs because it's mine. Put it back up. And the web host has to put it back up at that point because it's not their job to figure out when copyright infringement is and isn't going on. So as long as they comply with the notices when they get them, they're not going to get in trouble. But then if there's a situation where someone sends a takedown notice, gets something taken down, and the other person sends a counter takedown notice to get back up, if the original complainer thinks they're still in the right, at that point they have to sue the person.
So what are some common things? I mean, everyone has a little camera these days. Well, it could be their phone. And what's typically allowed that you own the content and what's not allowed? I'll give you an example. We have sports shows, so I'm taping interviews. Let's say Phoenix Mercury, maybe the D-backs, maybe the Arizona Rattlers, for example, some professional sports team. Who owns that content if I'm interviewing them and taking the video?
I would probably start with what are the contracts in place around that interview, because sometimes those issues are determined in advance.
Yeah.
But in general, the person who is recording is usually the person who owns the content.
Gotcha.
Like, for example, I'm a member of a choir, and we recently had a concert, and someone took a photograph of me. I don't own, even though I'm in the photo, I don't own the content. I don't own the copyright in it. And so when I saw the photo up on a website that I wasn't sure if the website owner had gotten the rights to use it. Because I know they saw it on my Facebook page is where I got it. So I sent them a note saying, hey, did you contact the guy who took the photo to make sure that it was okay with him before you put it up? Because I don't control it. It's not my photo. The only time I might have an argument that I had some control over a picture of me would be if the person who took the photo was commercializing it and making money off my image. But that's commercializing an image, not copyright.
So, okay. So I know Major League Baseball, I believe, have a 3-day rule where you can post videos and then you have to take them down. But I think I think we have to sign something to that extent. So that's what you're talking about with the contracts. I'm not sure the other sports teams, I've seen that. And so that's interesting. So the bottom line is know the rules or regulations of the particular organization, and that's probably the safest way.
Oh, yeah. Always
yeah.
Ask a lot of questions, get everything in writing,
yeah.
Whenever possible.
Now, are the rules a little different for minors? Because I've heard of an individual that took a picture of a child, mm-hmm. and they demanded that the picture be removed because of that, and they had to take it off because they didn't get permission of the child, the parent, before they posted it.
That's a really, interesting question. A lot of people ask me that a lot, where it's like if you have a birthday party for your kid and you take pictures of all the kids who come, and like, oh, is it okay if I post those pictures on Facebook, or do I need to get the parents' permission? I look at it from two angles of, okay, is there a law in place that says, that has a specific rule about minors and pictures, and that law may vary from state to state. But then also look at, what's good etiquette. A lot of issues about, pictures and video and statements online, it's as much a legal issue as it is an internet etiquette issue. And so, should you ask permission in advance versus do you have to?
Probably always a good idea to ask.
In general, I find it in most situations easier to ask permission than beg forgiveness.
Yeah.
Sure. And the what I was referencing, it might be because of a case where the child was involved with either the parent had a legal battle, custody battle, or there was abuse or whatever it was, they were forced to take the picture off. They were barred from putting any of the pictures of that person on the internet, so they were forced to take it off. And I didn't know if that was just a general law or etiquette, like you said,
yes.
Permission.
That is interesting. Why don't we take a quick break right now, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with special guest Ruth Carter. This is Breakthrough Networking, starring Al Fulton, live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. We'll be right back.
At Beerenbaum and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Beerenbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Ridenour, Heitzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Heitzen & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac, live from the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. First Tuesday of each month from 2 to 3, it is Breakthrough Networking, starring Al Fulton. Al, you picked a phenomenal guest, Ruth Carter. Thank you so much for being here. This is a great great education. I'm learning tons of stuff. I didn't even know what flash mob was.
Yeah, she's dynamic. She has knowledge in multiple areas. So we will continue asking and probing those vital questions that business owners need to know.
No doubt about it. Let me, before I ask the use of photos, what inspired you to be an attorney?
God.
God did?
No, it's just kind of a funny story. So before I went to law school, I worked in the mental health industry for 9 years, and it was no longer a good fit for me. I was a licensed counselor. I was kind of trapped in my office all day, and I really liked problem solving, and I liked people. But when you're a therapist, you kind of have to sit on your hands all day and let the client do the work, and you go at their pace. And I'm not a very patient person, so it's hard to sit back and wait for them to be ready to make changes in their lives. It just wasn't the right work situation for me anymore. And so I decided it was time for a change. And so somebody said, you can't go wrong with a law degree. And I thought, perfect. I will go to law school and I will have 3 years to figure out this career crisis. So I went to law school, and that's when I fell into blogging and social media and flash mobs and just fell in love. And since then, the pieces have just fallen into place.
Wow, good for you. So you went back. So you said 9 years?
9 years.
Wow. So you must have graduated really young. You look so young, that's why. But I know you said...
Feel free to tell people that, you know, I'm one of those geniuses who just, you know, like skipped elementary school.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
I went to college, I went to 12. Like five. And,
oh, five.
You know, yeah.
I was gonna
sure, say, we can 12. Tell people that.
Yes.
That is very good. I mean, it is impressive, I must say. Now, use of photos. Everyone seems to have a website these days. I mean, that's a thing to do. They're, you know, on mobile phones, all that stuff. So what's the do's and the don'ts on using photos? So let's start with a general question like that.
That's a really broad question. Are we talking about photos that you took yourself? Or
No, let's say photos that you just found on their website or Facebook or
okay.
Anything like that.
All right. This is a question I asked to a group of business owners recently. I was doing a talk on social media law, and I asked the group, about 40 people, where do you get the pictures for your blogs, your blog posts? And about 5 of them automatically said, Google Images.
Mm.
And I cringed, because Google Images is not where you go when you need a photo for your blog. Google Images is where you go when you want to inadvertently commit copyright infringement. Because Google will show you images, but they, unless you do an advanced search, you don't know if the owner is okay with you using their photo. So I always recommend that people look towards something like creativecommons.org, or if they're willing to pay money for photos, places like iStock and Getty Images and places like that, where you can purchase a license to use a photo. But Creative Commons is a place where people can share their photographs and give you a license that tells you how you're allowed to use it. Some photographers say you can use my photo for anything you want as long as you give an attribution. Other photographers may say you can use my photo as long as you don't modify it in any way. Other photographers say you can use my photos as long as you don't commercialize it, so you can't make money off my stuff. So I usually tell bloggers my unsolicited advice that I use for my own blogs. I use Creative Commons all the time, and I only pull photos that come with a license to modify it and commercialize them. And because the license to modify allows me to crop the photo if I want to or need to, and the license to commercialize the image allows me to make money off of it. Even for like my law firm's website, where I don't make money directly off my blog, it's still part of a larger commercial venture. And for people who maybe just have a recreational blog or as a hobby, and they think, well, I can have pictures that say don't commercialize because I'm not making money off my blog. And I say, well, that's true. You're not making money today, but someday you might. And when that happens, what you really need to do at that point is go back, figure out which photos don't let you commercialize it, rip them out, and replace them, which is a lot of work. So unfortunately for those business owners that day who said they've been using Google Images, I suggested, if I was in charge, I would say, you know, when you get back to the office, tell your webmaster to rip out every photo off your website and start over and make sure that you have that you either own or have permission to use every photo on your site. Because if you don't, you know, in the best case scenario, you'll just get a cease and desist letter that just says, hi, you're using my photo, take it down. Worst case scenario, you're going to get sued. And if someone has put all their ducks in a row, they could ask for a six-figure amount plus their attorney's fees.
So why would, from your experience, is it more common where they just ask you to take down the photos? Because you have to calculate damages, don't you, on if you get sued? I mean, what would the damages be?
And that would depend. If they could ask for what's called their actual damages, which is the amount of money that they lost and the other person made because they used the photo without permission.
And what if there was no money made?
If there was no money made, then you're suing for, you know, pride, potentially. However, if the photographer or whoever owns the copyright has really put their ducks in a row, the amount of money of the actual damages is irrelevant because they can ask for what's called statutory damages, where the court doesn't care how much money was made or lost due to the infringement. It's just an amount of money that is designed to punish the infringer, and it can go up to $150,000 per image plus attorney's fees.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you see that a lot?
I don't see it a lot, but more and more I'm seeing photographers getting angry when people are using their images without their permission. And so they could set themselves up for that situation where they could sue and ask for statutory damages, or they can set themselves up so that they do license their images to people for money. And then when someone uses the image without permission, they just send them a bill. And that's something that Getty Images is known for doing. I have a friend here in the Valley. That's exactly what happened to him. He sent me an email saying, I had a picture on my site and I got a bill from Getty. Do I really have to pay it? I said, let me look them up in the database. I'm pretty sure you do. So, you know, looked them up and I went, yeah, they have a history of suing people that don't pay the bill. So I told him, go back, figure out how much money you should have paid for using the image to date, take it off your site and make them an offer.
I have a quick question. Do the photographers need to copyright any of those images? Do they need to record it anywhere or like a normal patent, make two copies of it, put one in an envelope, put a date on it, you know, that go ahead.
Okay, there's a couple issues there. So the second you have an original work of authorship fixed in any tangible medium, you have copyright rights in it. So in terms of photographers, the second you snap a photo and it's saved to a computer file or onto film, they have the copyright rights in the work. They have the exclusive rights to, you know, copy, distribute, display, perform, and make derivative works based on their photograph. Now, if they want to be able to sue people for copyright infringement, you are required to register that with the U.S. Copyright Office. But that's not a requirement to just have rights in in the photos that they take. One thing you just mentioned, or at least you alluded to, is poor man's copyright, which is the idea that you can prove that you own the image by putting it in the mail and mailing it to yourself. Yeah, that's an old wives' tale. It doesn't actually work. I actually recently did my own experiment with it because the idea is, you know, people think, oh, you take your work, put it in an envelope, send it to yourself, don't open it, and the postmark serves as the date at least by which you had created it.
Correct.
So in case someone ever claims that they created the same work or was claiming your work as their own, you can say, hey, I have proof that I created it before you claim that you created it.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, when you do that, the postmark only tells you when the envelope went through the mail. It doesn't tell you when you put that piece of paper in the envelope. And to prove that, what I did recently is I took an envelope, put my address for the to and the from, put a stamp on it, and then I didn't seal it. I just tucked the envelope, little flap, into the back and sent it through the mail. So I have this envelope, you know, mailed to myself with a postmark on it. Nothing's in it. So who's to say when I'm going to put a piece of paper in it and seal it and claim, this is when I look at the postmark, that's when I made it. It's like, no, that's when that envelope went to the mail. It's not when you created whatever's inside of it.
Okay.
So
that's a really good point. I never thought of it that way. Because I've heard the same thing now, you know, where you could do that long ago. And that's a good point, because if you do it that way and then put it in long after, what about if you go to the post office, send it certified, and they somehow stamp the and you put tape over where it's sealed, and they actually, the post office stamps it?
How is that any different?
Well, she's still alluding to it's the poor man's copyright. That
well, because if the, if a third party does it, like the postmaster, and it's already sealed, so they would know if it broke the seal. You'd have to know it had to be at least that date and not after, because if it was still sealed and they post where it is sealed.
So it's kind of like when I remember people doing that, like letters of recommendation, they like sign over the seal where the envelope is sealed to prove that the envelope hadn't been opened.
Yeah. Interesting. It sort of defeats.
I look at that and go, why would you? If you are that,
yeah.
If you would be that meticulous about protecting your work, why wouldn't you just register it with the Copyright Office?
Good point.
Right.
That's a very good point, though. I never thought of that. Al, that's a great question.
Yes.
You win the Question of the Day award. Thanks. You know what the reward is? Or the award?
Milky Way bar?
No, you get to participate next January on the Flashdance Mob in 42-degree weather.
Oh, that sounds more like punishment. For me, it is.
That sounds interesting. But anyway, how about e-books? So do you deal with that as far as... If you do an ebook, is that copywritten automatically once you publish it online?
Even before it's published online, the second you have an original work fixed in a tangible medium, even if it's just a file on your computer, you have the exclusive rights to your work. You don't have to. You never have to publish it.
Really?
No, you have the rights, even if no one ever sees it.
So the days of sending a book to Washington D.C. or something, that you don't have to do that.
If you want to register it, you have to, yes.
What would be so what does registration mean versus copyright?
So you get your copyright rights the second you've created your work.
Yeah.
If you want to maximize your rights, which includes the right to sue people for copyright infringement, and especially if you want statutory damages, you have to register it with the Copyright Office. Which they've even, they've come up with the times. They, you can even register it online if you want.
Oh, you can?
Oh, yeah. They have a website. You can do it. It's pay with a credit card. Most works only cost $35 to register.
And that's per photo, or is it text only?
E-book.
For an e-book, it would be whatever you're claiming is one work. So if you wanted to claim one book, one blog post, one photograph, you could claim a collection of photos as one work.
Okay.
But then it's getting into a tricky situation. Like, let's say you have 100 photographs, mm-hmm. and you register them as one work, and somebody steals one picture from that collection and you want to sue them, you can. But when you're suing them, you're going to the court and saying, Your Honor, this person stole 1% of 1% of my work.
Mm-hmm.
So the chances of the court giving you a lot of money for stealing 1% of your work is pretty low, unless your work is so valuable that even stealing 1% is worth a lot of money.
Okay. So you can't, unless you register it, an ebook, for example, you can't sue.
You can't sue. You have to register before you sue.
Wow, that's interesting. So someone can just take your book and say it's theirs, and you have no recourse.
Well, you can register after you publish.
Oh, okay. So if someone does that, then how do you, how do you prove that, who did it first? I guess just through the computer blog?
Metadata.
That metadata. What's metadata now? You know what it is?
It's information that's recorded at the time something is created.
Oh.
Computers can save that. Like Adobe PDFs have metadata that show who the author is and any revisions, date, and content details.
So, but you would probably recommend always register or wait and see what happens?
It depends on the situation. I'd say talk to your intellectual property attorney about what's the right strategy for your specific situation. And we're talking about an ebook.
Yeah.
If it were me, at least when it was, you know, when I published my ebook last year, I registered my book on September 30th. I published on October 1st.
Oh, so register first.
That's what I do.
That's good. And you're an attorney.
Yes.
So I think that's a great idea. Is that the trend? I know you're not a publisher of any sort, but is that the trend where hard copies are going to be bye-bye soon?
I don't think so. Maybe eventually we'll lose hardbound books, but I don't think that's going to happen for a while. Some people still really love tangible books. But more and more, I think there is a movement towards at least offering a book when you publish in paper and electronically.
Very interesting. Let's take a quick break, another quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with special guest Ruth Carter, attorney, but not just any attorney, a flash mob attorney and social media wrote the book, The Legal Side of Blogging, How Not to Get Sued, Fired, Arrested, or Killed. That sounds scary. We'll be right back.
At Beerenbaum Baum and Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Beerenbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Do you owe money to the
Weidenauer, Heinzen & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Weidenauer, Heinzen & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
And welcome back again. You are listening to Breakthrough Thinking live here at the Regis Suites in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm Dave Isaac, the host, and the first Tuesday of each month from 2 to 3, it is Breakthrough Networking, starring Al Fulton. And Al, you brought in a great guest, like I mentioned at the start of the show, Ruth Carter, attorney. Ruth, thank you so much for being here. Phenomenal, interesting insights you're giving. I know a lot of attorneys, but I don't think I know attorneys that specialize in any of these areas. And it's so big, Al. We were all talking on the break, where if you're in business, maybe not even in business, but especially in business, if you don't have an attorney, a CPA, an IT guy at a minimum, and I think a business coach too, a good one works too. That's a big mistake. And even if you don't think you need an attorney, get on the phone and call an attorney. Just establish a relationship. Go to lunch, because I guarantee there's things you don't know. Just like a CPA, people trying to do their own tax return is not easy these days. It really isn't. And it could be an error. It depends on, if you just have a W-2, I guess that's okay. But if you're in business, there's just too many tax laws. And especially... What I really like about you is not only your youthful spirit, it's really cool, I love that, but really the fact that you specialize, you're ahead of the curve here, because the internet, social media, all this stuff is, it's right here, right now, and it's only going to get bigger, right?
Oh, yeah, it's only going to get bigger, it's only going to get more complicated, more and more people are going to get involved, and in terms of business, when social media became the thing to do, a lot of businesses just said, we got to do this. And they really had no idea what they were doing. And so they weren't consulting like proper marketing people to learn how to use these tools properly. And they definitely weren't contacting their attorneys to make sure they were, minding their P's and Q's properly. So that's what's getting a lot of companies in trouble.
Is law somewhat undeveloped in this area? So there's a lot of unknowns, and until court cases come around, you're really not exactly sure about certain things?
Oh, yeah. A lot of times we are working with laws that were written before we had the internet. And so we're trying to figure out how do these old laws apply to this new technology, and there are a lot of unknowns, and it's really important that when these issues go to court, that the decision is made properly the first time around so that we don't have to go back and fix it later. But we are definitely working with some outdated laws that need to be updated.
Which is challenging in itself. I mean, mm-hmm. it, as an attorney, and of course, she just put a pretend gun to her head for the audience, but because it is difficult. Luckily, she pointed at herself, so not me. That was good news, Al. I like that part. Now, but she's still alive here. Wait, that's in your title of your book, Not to Get Sued, Fired, Arrested, or Killed. But anyway, I know as a tax guy, if certain things come up, people get audited, there's history, there's court cases that you rely on, which can make it a little bit easier because it's right there. And if there's quite a bit of court cases supporting you or not, at least you know. Still, you can make a case. But when there's undeveloped law like that, how challenging is that? Do you get to be more creative?
Sometimes. You have to look at what law applies, and you have to look at the actual verbiage they use to see if you can expand it or if it was written in such a way that it would apply to a situation like, for example, like stalking and harassment. When a lot of states originally wrote these laws, they required the physical proximity between perpetrator and victim. And then when we shifted to the internet with cyber stalking and cyber harassment, it was really hard to get these laws to apply because there wasn't a physical proximity always between the alleged perpetrator and their victim. And so That's why states had to either revise their harassment laws or write new ones to deal with electronic problems.
So is that such a thing, stalking harassment on the Internet?
Absolutely.
And is that getting, sadly, a lot more common these days?
Yes.
Wait, is that the bully stuff you hear about? Is that part of it?
It's bullying. I look at bullying and harassment as basically the same. We usually use the term bullying when we're talking about children and harassment when we're talking about adults. But when you look at the actual behavior, it's often really similar.
Wow, that's amazing. And how about harassing texts?
Text messages?
Is that also under these laws?
Yeah, same thing. Sometimes they have to make sure they write the law expansively enough to just cover electronic communications and not limit it to saying, you know, internet phone. It's like, well, what's the next technology? We have to make sure that whatever comes down the pike next, that the law is going to apply to that too.
And how do you define, like, harassment on text? I mean, what would that mean?
I would probably say it's probably the same as via text as it would if someone was harassing you in person. And harassment is a state law issue, so you have to look at how does each state define harassment and cyber harassment. But usually it's, you know, communications designed to harass, threaten, annoy, things like that.
So annoying too.
Well, you know, if someone's texting you, 100 times a day, yeah. I would call that harassment.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. Wow. That's interesting. Al, did you know any of this stuff? I didn't know any of this stuff.
No, I have come to the enlightenment that I don't know what I don't know. So I am a sponge these days to just absorb all of this information. This is great.
It really is. This is like... And it's great because it involves so many things. It involves a human element. It involves technology. And as technology keeps kicking up and getting more sophisticated, that means the speed, the access can accelerate harassment and stalking. I mean, it can accelerate these events.
Absolutely. And whereas, like, if a child is being bullied at school, it used to be that at the end of the day, he got to go home and escape his bullies. Now, because of the internet and text messages and whatnot, he can't get away. And he has to deal with it 24/7, not just, you know, feel badly 24/7, but could be constantly bombarded with harassing messages from the people who are bullying him.
Wow. What about internet dating? Any laws surrounding that you deal with?
I can't think of any laws that apply specifically to internet dating.
Yeah. That's been around for a while, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a new version of, you know, the classified ad dating.
Yeah.
Just now it's online.
Yeah. But that's pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there will be ever, I guess that's well established, I guess.
It's well established, yeah. And each dating website sets their own, you know, rules and their terms of service about, you know, of course everyone has like the general, you know, do's and don'ts, don't break the law, but each site can say, you know, these are some additional rules that apply to you when you use this site.
Yeah.
And the disclaimers that say we're not responsible for any actions of the either parties on either side.
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah, that's we're not responsible if you're silly enough to get married. No, I'm just kidding. That was my marriage bashing comment.
Okay. So, Ruth, do you have some examples of what you know, things that you talked about in the book, to do's and don'ts in blogging?
That's a loaded question. Yeah. So, basic do's and don'ts. Whatever you're putting out on the internet, make sure that you either own it, that you wrote it or created it yourself, or have permission to use it. I have two rules of thumb that I tell everybody. Number one, don't post anything online that you wouldn't put on the front page of the newspaper. If you're going to put it out there, you better be willing to own it in every situation. And it's assumed that no matter if it's talking about your blog or a social media site, I don't care what your privacy settings are, what you think they are, assume that everybody can see everything that you post. And then likewise, assume that everything that you post will be seen by four people: your best friend, your worst enemy, your boss, and your mother. If you are not okay with one of those people seeing what you are thinking about posting online, don't post it.
Okay.
Because you never know what's going to come back and bite you in the butt.
Wow. So let's go over that. So your best friend, your
worst enemy.
Worst enemy.
Your boss.
Boss.
And your mother.
Oh, that's a good rules.
Well, let's talk about the boss, because the rumors that we hear that companies are using Facebook, what's being posted, said, or and it's not just videos, but pictures and texts between people, using that to determine if a person should keep their job or not, and expound.
Absolutely. There are employers who will go onto Facebook and look up their employees to see what they're doing, which it's kind of a loaded situation because on one hand, they may see something like may learn about more about a person's race, religion, maybe a disability that they didn't otherwise know about. Whereas if they fire the employee later, the employee may go back and say, they fired me for an illegal reason. You know, you can't fire people because of things like race, religion, disability, blah, blah, blah. On the flip side, if you're, you know, posting pictures of you, you know, getting drunk with your friends or doing other things that maybe suggest that you have bad judgment, or if you're ranting about your job. There was recently a situation where, like, a woman posted something, I believe it was on Facebook, where she basically, like taunted her employer to fire her, and they fired her. and she actually, this went through the what's called the National Labor Relations Board, and they said, yeah, that was a legal firing. Now, there is a law called the National Labor Relations Act, which protects unions and union-like activities, like employees' abilities to talk amongst each other about wages and work conditions. And if employees are having those conversations, whether they're having them in person or online, they are often protected. And even if the employee is not saying kind things about the employer, they often can't stop them. And if they do, if they fire them because of it, it's illegal. So, but it's sometimes hard for an employee to realize in the moment, and is what I'm talking about with my fellow employees, a protected activity talking about work, or if it's just, you know, ranting, they could get fired. And
now, you said the key word union. They're protected under union. How about non-union?
Even non-union, because the laws, whether you are unionized or not, the laws are designed to protect people who want to talk about their work conditions or things along those lines, whether they are in a union or not.
How about the individual that signs a employee handbook that says that one of the rules stipulate that they cannot talk about their compensation with other employees, and then they do it online? Can they be fired for
that? So potentially, now this law only applies to employees, not supervisors. It only applies to the private sector, not people in government positions. But a lot of times these laws are written too broadly. And so the employer didn't have an attorney review the handbook before they started using it. So, yeah, if their policy is too broad and they fire somebody for violating the rule and they get turned into the National Labor Relations Board, in the worst-case scenario, they're going to have to pay that employee back wages, damages, and possibly offer them their job back.
Wow, how awkward that would that be.
It's awkward, and my lawyer friend who litigates these situations, I write these policies on the front end, he litigates on the back end. He says if it goes to litigation and the employer loses, and if they have to pay the employee, or now ex-employee, $10,000, they got off easy.
Wow.
Yes.
That is amazing. So many things going on, and how do you keep up with all this?
The same way I've always kept up with it. I'm really lucky that I have a great connection within the social media and marketing community, and I just constantly watch them and see what they're doing, what's happening next, what are the government agencies that regulate these things, what are they saying, and just try to keep up, because every day there are new developments on, you know, how does the law apply, what are people doing, and how do we effectively use these tools without getting ourselves into trouble.
Wow, that is just incredible, all this stuff. I would think some good contacts for you or collaborations would be web designers, right? Is that what you do? Is you get to know a lot of web people so they can write up front, sort of sort things out?
Web designers, people involved in marketing, social media, entrepreneurs, business owners who are trying to make sure that they're doing things right, or they want to make sure that, you know, the way they've been doing things is actually legal. All those types of people.
Wow. So this is just a huge field. Do you see yourself really, as this field grows bigger, mainly specializing in that or concentrating on that?
I hope so. I really love this area of law, so I hope I get to run with it for a long time.
Oh, I can imagine. I think that's right, Al. I mean, you're
yep.
right in the middle of IT. I mean, this is what's happening.
That is it. This will be around for at least 10 years. The Internet's not going away. More and more content every day.
Really? What happens after 10 years?
Re-listen to the show we had about a 2 months ago where we talked about it's not subliminal, but as you walk into...
Oh, yeah, you didn't tell me.
Yes,
yeah.
The things will appear because of your
super internet in a different format.
Yes, directly.
Like Google Glasses.
Yes.
Yeah.
It would be personalized.
That, we know someone that's going to test that out, by the way. He's one of 8,000 in the world.
Oh.
Yeah.
On the entertainment show?
Yeah. Pretty interesting.
I'll be there.
He will be wearing those Google Glasses.
Cool.
That is pretty amazing. Yeah, that's going to be cool. We should have an audience on that day. Anyway, wow, Ruth Carter, you're going to stay for the next show, which is The Bottom Line, starring Mitchell Spean. And there's a lot more questions I have. I was surprised. I didn't get through half my questions. This is fascinating. This is Breakthrough Thinking, starring, of course, Al Fulton, Breakthrough Networking. And we'll be right back at 3. Mitchell Spean, The Bottom Line.